work at the Universidad de la República.
No, it's too much to go.
Which somehow in this program comes out very small. Okay, so constraint-free canonical DR.
Yeah, that's great.
That's perfect.
It is perfect.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so here's the plan of the talk. I'll start by telling you what that is, constraint-free canonical data, specifically why it's interesting to study, and why it wasn't done sooner, or you can get into more details, and finally finish with some small comments on progress. Okay, so constraint-free canonical gravity, well, I guess it's really just about everybody here is quite familiar with constraint full canonical gravity. And you all know that dealing with the constraints is the biggest headache in the whole game. Headache, well, it's the bulk of the work in any case. So this is just canonical general relativity using initial data. It's straight-free character with characteristic data. So it's using initial data on a piecewise null hypersurface, which could be a future light cone, but I won't use that. I'll use another type of piecewise null hypersurface made of two intersecting null hypersurfaces or light fronts, like an open book in space-time. Okay. So each of these branches, n right and n left, are swept out by the two ways of seeing it. You have here a two-dimensional space-like surface, which I've drawn here as a line because it's visualized in 2 plus 1 dimensions, but in 3 plus 1 space-time, it's a disk in my analysis. And out of this comes normally this in a two-dimensional space like this in space-time. So it's a space like, it's a disk at an instant of time. And at that instant emerges from both sides of this disk null geodesics going away normally, and these sweep out these two null hypersurfaces. Or alternately, you can think that this disk is that you can somehow make it hot very quickly, so it emits some light, and this produces two light pulses that propagate away from the disk, and we sweep out these surfaces.
Why do you take a disk and not a sphere?
Because you can make anything out of disks, but you can only make a sphere as a.
Then there is
can't put them together to make.
Then there is boundary. There's the boundary of the disk, which will be additional.
No, it doesn't bring any additional data, but it is a little bit more complicated. But the thing is that you can then think about the local problem of what happens in an arbitrarily small region around one of these null geodesics, which are called general things. Okay. Whereas if you have a sphere, then well, it has a certain size. And can't really talk about a piece of it on the same terms.
But for the country, I mean, ideally, you want to close, like if you're talking about black hole or whatever.
Well, yeah, you can simply put you want to close this, and in fact, you can simply just translate the analysis to the sphere. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it becomes essentially the same. Because really, well, I was going to mention this later, but if you think about it, all displacements on these surfaces, except along the generators, are space-like displacements. So really, what goes on here doesn't know anything about what goes on here. It doesn't know that there's a boundary. So really, these edges have very little influence. Quite to the contrary, what goes on at test zero is very important to what goes on. All the rest of the surface.
cost case.
Right, so we'll get to that. So we, let's just say for now that the surfaces are truncated at other disks before any caustic or any crossing is formed. And here's just a diagram of how the 3 plus 1 case, but without embedding into space time. So you have two cylindrical cans and a disk in the middle. Okay, so this initial data on such a pair of null hypersurfaces, or piecewise null hypersurface, determines the gravitational field in its domain of dependence, which is a four-dimensional region. And here I've drawn what it looks like in Minkowski's case. And so why would one want to study this? Well, first of all, what I said at the beginning, there are no constraints. You can identify free, complete initial data. And this was already done around 1962 by a whole bunch of people, Sachs, Bondi, Van der Burg, Metzner, Penrose, Balcourt, which maybe I already mentioned. Balcourt always said, well, I shouldn't feel sorry for him. He has a job at Max Planck in Potsdam, which is a nice place to work. But I think he did the most thorough job, and he did it first. And he got the least credit because he was a graduate student in East Germany, and all these other guys were.
And he has a French name.
That was.
It was German and
English. The other things he still could get away with. But his name that inspired mistrust. So, well, unlike some other approaches to, if you want to approach a quantum gravity list with this. Approach. You're already starting in a Lorentzian context, and so you know. I mean, many people start in a Euclidean context and then try to get across to Lorentzian, which might be good or might not. I don't know, but it's interesting to start already in a Lorentzian context because it's not clear that you can do a weak rotation in gravity. Although, I mean, you see with the spin foams that certainly there's a very close, you can sort of go across from the Euclidean to the Lorentzian in that approach. Another thing that's nice about it is that it's rather closely related to what one can actually observe in a gravitational field. I mean, people make propose observables for conceptual analysis in quantum gravity and say things, suppose space-time is full, has a scalar field, in fact, suppose there are four scalar fields and then we can locate points and so forth. But the problem is there aren't four scalar fields, or at least if there are, we don't know about them. So the things we actually measure when we make observations are not things made out of four scalar fields evaluating the fifth one that were at the given values of the first four. I mean, that's conceptually nice. These are rather what you can make out of here. The data basically tells you how these generators twist as they propagate. And that's all rather closely related to observables that you deal with in astronomy. So it seems, I haven't pursued this at all, but it seems like a nice framework to analyze issues of observables. In connection with that, perhaps it's worth mentioning, I mean, we always like to work with space-like hypersurfaces, but this is, which is not technically wrong, it has many advantages, but the reason we find this intuitively appealing is just a holdover from Newtonian theory. We're used to thinking that what we know is everything is the world at this instant. But that's not true. What we know is the world in our past light cone and some things inside it. So really, data on a null hypersurface, although this would be, you know, if it's going to the past, this is fairly natural. And time evolution is conceptually straightforward. Well, it's not mathematically straightforward, but at least you have a fairly natural idea of how to evolve in time. You can imagine defining an evolution where you slide this branch forward along the other branch, and this would be a real evolution and not a pure gauge. Isn't it because it's totally gauge fixed now?
When you say time evolution, do you mean there's one time or there's many, many times?
But you don't, there are many times, but they're real times. They're not like the Hamiltonian constraint, which doesn't produce time evolution at all. But of course, you can make up other times in
but is it the evolution that changed the phase space, or that?
Transformation
of the phase space.
It's not a transformation of the phase space. It's more tricky than that, because as you slide this forward, part of the slice which is predicted by the initial data, it becomes smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. You can see very easily. You can certainly calculate in principle what the data is on a smaller slice to the future, but you could not use this data on this slice to the future to retrodict what was in the first slice.
It's not really a unitary evolution.
No, but there is notion of change in time. In only in that sense is conceptually straightforward. To have really unitary evolution, you would be restricted to have something like a globally hyperbolic space-time. You have to have a globally hyperbolic space-time. And then Cauchy surfaces of the globally hyperbolic space-time. Evolution from one to another.
But why do you have these feature directed type surfaces and not past direct like the past?
There's no profound reason. It's just if you think about the initial value problem, then just to give you initial data, then it should predict what's to the future. But I could everything is exactly the same if I make a final value problem where this flipped over to the past.
Why don't we just have like a past like a
Then I could calculate what's to the past.
But you can also calculate the future too. Very easy.
No, because then signals could come in. They could come in. Here's the past life. So signal could come in here, not be registered anywhere here, and change much as you like. Okay, so if going over almost to the edge, but so this is my real reason to start working on this. I think this is a potential means to understand a holographic principle in the form it was originally proposed. I missed the little dash. So Bekenstein and Tuff and Suskin and Busso successively refined a conjecture bound on entropy of systems in some sense. Here's Busso's version of a bound on entropy, and in fact Busso only makes a claim about the entropy of matter in a gravitational background, but it's a specific statement of a more general idea. I'm sorry, maybe this talk is too elementary for this audience, but okay, I'll just keep going. Drop me if you have questions. Okay, so what Puzo says is the following thing. Imagine taking one branch of one of these this pair of null hypersurfaces, just take one of them, and impose the requirement that the generators, when they come out here from S0, are either converging or parallel. Okay, so seen from the side where they come out, S0 has to be convex or flat. Roughly speaking. Okay. And then he claims the following, that the entropy of these matter fields on this branch NR.
So what do you mean by entropy on?
Okay, so what Puzo means by that is he supposes that the matter is such that there is a well-defined entropy for current. And what he means by the entropy is simply the flux of the entropy for current over the surface. Yeah. So once you have a
but as you say, there's all these things that can skim the surface with the chain.
Right.
But I take only one branch. I can add an arbitrary number of stuff nearby without changing the data on the surface.
Yeah, you could do that nearby. I mean, Puzo set up in order that there exist a well-defined entropy for current. Well, I guess if you have several non-interacting fluids, you could certainly have some radiation skimming by like this without disturbing the fact that you could sum up the entropy for currents of everything instead of a well-defined current. I was just wondering whether that situation was inside when Russo's ideas. But yeah, okay, well, so this is the claim. I'll just tell you what the claim is. Because this is, Boussus is maybe the most definite version of a class of heuristic principles. Okay, so let me just tell you what the claim is, and then we're going to go to more definite things. In fact, my interest in this comes from trying to make more definite these claims. So he defines entropy with this flux of entropy for current, and he claims that this entropy, the surface, has to be less than the area of this two-dimensional disk here that generated the three surface divided by four times the Planck area. This is, of course, the entropy. This formula is, of course, the formula for the entropy of a black hole. So it's less than the entropy of a piece of event horizon of this size. Okay. With the saturation being possible, and you can make up examples where this is saturated. Okay, so now normally.
Even violating. Because we have an universe near the singularity.
Yeah, but there are always. You're always getting within Planck lengths of things, or other things are getting. So if you think that there's a quantum theory, you maybe shouldn't.
Maybe.
I mean, you would want to really violate this and be convinced that it's not a good hypothesis for the real universe. You would have to have some clearly semi-classical or a classical situation where you don't have things that, for instance, stars that are, you know, their Schwarzschild radius is within a Planck length of their surface, you know, so they're not really collapsed, they're not black holes, but they're just incredibly close to being such. And you can also violate the boundary. But in a sense, you could say that you probably.
I think you use singularities.
No, but this is another case. In fact, there was a talk about that here.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a theory of congruity, maybe it's true.
Yeah, so.
I'm just saying that the fact that it's never violated is
It's never,
you know, need qualification.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so, but it's violated, as far as I know, all the violations are in contexts where the applicability of classical ideas is ambiguous. Okay, so normally, if you have a physical system, and it's a physical system that will have a certain state of maximum entropy, its equilibrium state, and this state of maximum entropy, it has the largest number compared to all other microstates, has the largest number of microstates in the system. But when you study statistical mechanics, you probably noticed, and it was probably even pointed out to you, that not only is this true, almost always, or in fact, yeah, all the cases that one encounters in practice, not only does the equilibrium state, the maximum entropy state, have more microstates than all the other possible thermodynamic states, it has almost all the microstates. Okay. So, for instance, talk about the air in this room. There's the maximum entropy state has the air distributed uniformly in the room within some small tolerances. And then you can calculate how many states of the system are there where this is the case versus how many states other macroscopic distributions of density of the air in the room. With some energy bound. And when it's not uniformly distributed, and you find that if you don't make the tolerances on the uniformity of the density absurdly small, then basically all of the number of microstates with the uniform distribution is vastly greater than all the other possible microstates. So, so this leads to a hypothesis based on that you can take out of this statement, and that is that the dimensionality of the Hilbert space, which you somehow associate with NR, is equal to the exponential of this maximum entropy. This would be the dimensionality of the subspace of the Hilbert space associated with the maximum entropy state, but if the maximum entropy state has essentially all the microstates, then the dimensionality of the whole Hilbert space should be very close to the dimensionality of the Hilbert space compatible with the maximum entropy macrostate. Okay? So now, alternatively, you could take both of these branches and suppose that Busso's bound applies, and then you could say the dimensionality of the Hilbert space associated with both branches should be just the square of this exponential of A S zero divided by 2 times the Planck area. So the first thing that's nice about this is, of course, this Hilbert space makes much more sense than the other one, because this whole hypersurface has a domain of dependence. Therefore, you can talk about a space of solutions of the gravitational field equations, or of any field equations, within this domain of dependence. There's a phase space, and it could be a corresponding Hilbert space. Whereas it's not really clear what this Hilbert space here would be. I should make a little comment here. You might wonder, can you really make sure that the generators are converging or parallel coming out on both sides of this disk? You might think, oh no, you have to be inside of a black hole to do that, because they're contracting on both sides. But this is not true. You have to be inside of a black hole if this were a closed sphere, closed surface. It's not a closed surface. It's very easy to construct, in fact, in flat space-time, an example that satisfies these conditions. Just think of two past light cones that intersect on a two-surface. And obviously, you can easily demonstrate that the generators of these light cones are normal to this intersection surface, and that they're contracting on both sides. There's the intersection surface. Okay. So this can, in fact, you can meet Boussard's requirements. Always. Okay. Also, I should say that I switched a little bit when I'm talking about. Boussard was only talking about the entropy of matter fields on a gravitational background, and in fact, not any matter field. Matter fields that are in a sort of a state of local equilibrium, which allows you to define an entropy fork current. Of course, you can make the statement about those matter fields, but it's, whereas this, that statement about the matter fields has no hope of being a fundamental statement about nature, here it's tempting to take this as perhaps a statement about the actual theory, and not just about some particular class of states of that theory. And then, of course, well, what's simpler then considering instead of matter fields, just the gravitational field in vacuum. That's what I'll be concerned with. Okay, so this is all very heuristic stuff, but if you play around with it, not unreasonable stuff. And this, but it of course begs the question, how could you go away from just having heuristic arguments and make a real argument? And, well, the most obvious thing is just to find the classical phase space for the gravitational field in this domain of dependence, and then try to quantize and get a Hilbert space. So this canonical general relativity on this pair of null hypersurfaces seems like the ideal framework to try to check these hypotheses. Okay, so one question one might have immediately, you saw that these data were discovered in 1962, so why wasn't this done before? I mean, holography maybe wasn't a concern, but of course people would have been more than happy to have some version of general relativity without constraints. And so there are two reasons. One of them is basically a conceptual and partly psychological reason, which I think is the more important one historically, and that's that the generators of these null hypersurfaces will eventually, generically, will eventually focus. And in fact, even if they don't focus, they can cross. And this is a very, very serious problem. So here I've drawn an example. Here you have, again, 2+1 dimensions. Here you have S0 as the shape of sort of half of a racetrack. And here are the normal null geodesics going away. And the part that's over the semicircle is, of course, just half of a light cone, which has a vertex here where they all meet. And here, this part where the track is straight, well, the light rays just go parallel. And they don't focus, but they do cross. Right? And this is generically what happens. You have a caustic, and once the caustic point is reached, and next to it, there's a whole line of crossing points. Okay? And the moment, as you can see, the moment that the generators cross, they start to enter the future of this initial data hypersurface. In fact, they enter into the domain of dependence. And that's, of course, a serious problem, because you were so happy that you had data that had no constraints on it. But now you have a situation where on these parts, after the crossing, the data is completely determined by the data and the rest of the surface. So you had no constraints coming, say, infinitesimally or locally from Einstein's equations, but these global constraints come in and ruin everything. They're much worse. So this, of course, was very discouraging to people. And basically, so what you do? Somehow you have to cut off the surface before you get there. But you can't just say, we cut off the surface. I mean, you have to put some conditions on the initial data so that you're sure that this isn't happening for that initial data set. And so then even if you don't manage to have that, then, first of all, again, you have some restrictions on the data, right? You were happy that you had free data, and now you have these conditions. Secondly, these conditions promise to be very complicated, and in fact, nobody could find these conditions. Or at least that was sort of the feeling. And so a feeling grew up that, best not to go there. It's dangerous, there are dragons. But this is actually basically a non-problem. The actual caustics, the point where neighboring geodesics meet, can be eliminated quite easily, can be cut out quite easily. That's easily detected in the initial data. You just put a restriction on it, a very simple restriction. And the way I set it up, it's just a restriction on the domain of the data. So this can be cut out easily. But what about these crossings? Well, it turns out there's nothing you can do to take them away, no conditions you can put on the initial data. And in fact, it's totally superfluous. It's impossible, and there's no need to do it, because if you have a space-time in which the surface is crossing, you can always construct another space-time, which is locally isometric, and therefore is also a solution to Einstein's equation, in which they don't cross. You can unidentify the crossing. And so...
Can you explain that a bit more?
Okay. So you mean how you do it or why? Okay, so what you do is very simple. You use the exponential mapping to pull back the metric to the normal bundle of S0. Okay? And in the normal bundle, these generators, which are just the straight lines coming out of the radial straight lines in the fibers, it is never crossed by definition, the way it's constructed. So then you have a new space-time, which is locally isometric, solution of Einstein's equation, where the generators don't cross and you have the same initial data. Therefore, the initial data was good initial data for a certain space-time. And you didn't have to worry about any consistency between data here and data here. I mean, of course, there will be some space-times where there is this crossing, and those are those space-times where there is an isometry which allows you to identify two regions so that the surface crosses. But this is not, but you don't have, for this reason, any restriction on the initial data. Whatever initial data you put, there is some space-time and the solution to Einstein's equation, some solution to Einstein's equation corresponds to this initial.
As long as there's no caustic, that's just enough.
Right, so you just have to take out the caustic, but you don't have to worry separately about the process. And the caustic itself is easy to take out from the data. Okay. So the second reason this was not done, because some people did, there were some research groups that.
So it's just the caustic is always going to be what dimension? Is it going to be a two-sphere, or is it going to be higher than that?
I guess it's, I mean, there's a whole literature on caustics, but...
What is the maximum dimension?
It should be... Yes, two.
Two is the maximum. Yeah.
Well, what you see in a moment, I mean, it's very simple. You can put coordinates on these surfaces such that the crossing star is in the same place. Leave that place out. Okay, so the other problem is that it's hard to do. Some groups did try to calculate the. Okay, what's hard to do is find the Poisson branches.
Maybe a last question on that. I mean, I guess for your theorem to be true, you have to take away the caustics, but also you're assuming that the length of the generator on N is finite. Or is it even true if I have an N which has no boundary? You're assuming that N has zero as boundary on one side, or maybe some other boundary on the other.
No, I'm implicitly always assuming that N is complex.
That is complex.
Actually, it's explicitly
in the written word.
It's not true if it's not compact, but you just. Or it's not known.
If it's not compact, then you couldn't put these. Then the only case in which they don't form a caustic in a compact interval is when they're completely parallel to each other. And there's, either flat space-time or some geometry where for some strange reason there's no focus. It's a very non-generic situation. One asymptotic infinity is one situation. But in any case, then there wouldn't be a problem. Ed Whitten should become interested in this, and he would soon find that by studying the cohomology or the theoretical cohomology of the Nefertiti string in minus two dimensions, it just falls out without any calculus whatsoever. But
this is broadcasted now.
Okay, so. So now what I'd like to do is enter a little bit more into the details. I want to tell you what the free initial beta are, more or less. And I want to tell you a little bit how the brackets are, and then a little bit about quantization. So to explain the free initial beta, I have to tell you what the coordinates adapted to the Snell hypersurface that I use. Okay? So there's something very simple. Here's again one branch of this null hypersurface. So I put any pair of two-dimensional, a nice chart, any chart on S0. The disk from which the generators start, and I carry these along a Hoven constant on the generators, sort of convection to the whole N bar. Okay. Then I need a parameter. So that gives me two coordinates. It allows me to identify the generator at each point that I'm on. And I need a parameter along each generator to give me three coordinates to fix a point completely. And so I define this parameter V, which is defined as follows. If I have a little bundle of neighboring generators, then this bundle will have a cross-sectional area A0, S0. And we'll have some other cross-sectional area further on. Because this is a null hypersurface, it actually doesn't matter how I cut this at what angle I cut this. It's the same area. Just depends where. Okay? Where along this generator, the central generator. And I'm talking about using this one. Okay. And I define B as follows. I just say that the area here at a certain value of B is V squared times the area at zero. On a light cone in flat space, this gives you simply the the metric distance, I mean, if you, maybe I should point to that.
I mean,
in flat space, this gives you the kind of fine.
So that in general, space time can always find such a parameter that the condition is satisfied.
Yeah, you can. Well, you require actually for this to work everywhere. You need that the generators at the surface are either everywhere contracting, converging, everywhere diverging, or well, and if they're parallel, you can't do it at all. But since I'm working with a disk, I can always if I insist on treating some particular region of space-time, I can always make the disk small enough so that this is true, unless I'm at a point where they're really exactly parallel.
A lot of the change is this parameter is unique, or we have many parameters satisfy this condition?
No, it's what
the
definition
of the parameter.
It's quite unique. Well, I just take v squared or this v, I mean, it's all positive numbers. So v is just the square root of a at v, well, at a at the point, p, I should have said, divided by a zero. So I can just, I go to a point here, I measure A, and then I just divide that number by the area of some of the root points here of the generators, take the square root, and that's B.
Completely defined procedure.
So the parameter is not unique, because you can choose different cut.
No, but it doesn't matter, because this is not a cylinder in space, this is null, so when you move it like this, nothing changes. That's the tricky point, right? because distances along in these directions are all zero. Okay. So there are two types of. So now that you know the coordinates, I can tell you what the data are. There are two types. This bulk data that lives on all of the three manifolds, and left and right. Okay. And there's other data that lives at S0, and I will define that data, I'll just show it to you, but let me explain in a little bit more detail how this bulk data works. In some sense, it's most of the data, but it's not the most important. Okay, so the bulk data is something called a conformal 2 metric, which is a 2x2 matrix as a function of theta 1, theta 2, and b. And the metric on these hypersurfaces are null, are degenerate because it's null. And you can write the line element like this, ds squared is equal to some coefficient times just d theta terms, because just the v direction is null, there are no dv terms appearing. So you just need a 2x2 matrix, not a 3x3 matrix of metric coefficients. Okay? So this is again this phenomenon I was talking about. And this so-called conformal 2 metric is defined by simply taking this two-dimensional metric and dividing it by the square root of its determinant. And this way you get a determinant 1 object, E. Unimodular 2x2 matrix, symmetric 2x2 matrix, which incidentally has 2 degrees of freedom, which is sort of what you would hope for. Actually, it is correct. And so then there's also some data on the two surface where the two non-surfaces meet. And so let me just rattle it off quickly. I just want to show you the completeness today. This is the area density on the two surfaces. There is basically the inner product of the two of the tangent vectors to the generators going along the two null hypersurfaces. Then there's a sort of a kind of extrinsic curvature-like expression, which is sometimes called a twist. And then there's a sort of a weird thing here. It's a diffeomorphism from the two truncating surfaces, the two disks at the ends of the two null hypersurfaces, SL and SR, which is defined by following the generator from SL to S0 and then from S0 to SR. You might think, well, how can a diffeomorphism be an initial datum? Because you're very, and in fact, in the earlier in the literature on this, this never appeared before. Because you're used to thinking, well, in general relativity, diffeomorphisms are gauge, right? So if something is a diffeomorphism, you can always apply a diffeomorphism to make this one. So why would you want this? But it's not true, okay? And this is a dynamical system, a Lagrangian system with a boundary. And the gauge symmetries are not all diffeomorphisms are gauge. Some diffeomorphisms that move the boundary are not gauge. Right? Some diffeomorphisms that move the boundary within itself are not gauge. So part of this is gauge, but part of it is. Okay, so now I want to tell you, I've told you what the data are. Let me show you one of the brackets.
Yeah. Can you define more precisely how you define the diffeomorphism? Because you say that you have only one set of coordinates, theta 1, theta 2, and then you move one there, you move one there. So I have only one set of coordinates here.
I could
technically which map of theta 1, theta 2 are you?
I think it's not as a matter one to record. You can think of it two ways, abstractly. This is a manifold. Points have identity in a manifold. So it's just a map from the points here to the points here. Alternatively, you can put some coordinates here, and then it'll be a map from R2 to R2.
Yeah, but given the coordinates you have chosen, yeah, this theta 1, theta 2, then this map is the identity in these coordinates.
Yes,
okay.
But then if you go...
So in this coordinate, it's hard to imagine that guy is an external linear thing. You're working in a coordinate where this map is always...
Yeah, but then, so then if I change the data, then it will no longer be one. If I change the gravitational field, it will no longer be one.
So
of course, you could then adapt the coordinates again, so that again it's one. But then you have what you could call a moving coordinate system. Okay? You have
to
be careful.
This coordinate you were working with are a gauge which is not compatible with theta 1. It's theta 1, theta 2, therefore. Because you want to.
Theta 1, theta 2 don't even come into the definition because you follow the generators here and you can see here. So what.
I'm saying theta 1, theta 2, you just told us that theta 1, theta 2 are a way to label any, you know, transverse surface. Therefore, SL and SY. So in this coordinate system, there's no phi. That's really what I'm saying.
Yeah,
there's
but no these are not fixed manifold coordinates. These are like normal coordinates that adapt themselves to the metric equivalent manifold. And then this is actually an important difference. A manifold a priori is a set of points which has identities, you can put the coordinate system, but then these coordinates don't move. Then you can put a metric on top of that, and you can drag this metric around.
My question is not conceptual, my question is practical.
Yeah.
So in the coordinate you just derived so far, this diffeomorphism phi is one. So can you, you know, if I think of this diffeomorphism as a map from theta 1, theta 2 to another theta prime 1, theta prime 2, how do I explicitly write this map and compute its bracket? I mean, I understand the general blah, 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 but
right.
At some point you have to parameterize this.
Right, so you have to put some fixed coordinates on SR and SL. And then you have a map between the thetas and these fixed coordinates, and you put these two maps together, then you get a map between two fixed coordinate systems on SL. And this is.
What about the coordinates theta 1, theta 2? If I make a diffeo on them, Is it gauge or is it for physical?
The data I gave you now, so certainly that is gauge.
I do change the mu, so.
Yeah,
that is, yeah, anyway, take mu equal to zero if I change the coordinates. So in some sense, these ones are physical, these coordinates.
Right, so the way I did something in the little bit between two approaches. So I drove that down. Yeah, so definitely the theta coordinates are here.
Well, because on the sphere, for instance, right, by choosing the right coordinate, I can always choose mu to be equal to zero.
Yeah, I could do that, and then I could gauge fix it by that condition. But I could only do it at one, let's say, S zero.
Yes. Okay, you can do it only once.
In fact, that's one way if you feel uncomfortable, although it's not incorrect what I said about the phi. I mean, you could do it that way. You could fix, or maybe I'm complicating more because I really have to introduce some more concepts, but you could fix the coordinates on SL and SR so that the mu's are zero in that case, and then the phi becomes left. I've gone back to shows. So where was I? So I defined the data. And right now I wanted to show you the brackets. And I just show you the brackets of E and E.
So did you define them?
Yeah.
Am I mean, okay with it? I know the people are seeing.
Yeah, here it is.
No, the twist and
no, I mean this is I just put them here to mention them. I think it's to talk about it in detail just much longer talk or series of talks. Okay, this maybe in the future if this approach proves successful, people will invest many hours. But at this point, I should leave that out. So to state these the brackets, the Poisson brackets of the E's, it's convenient to state to parameterize again these EABs instead of by a 2x2 matrix by a complex scalar. Okay? And you do it this way. I mean, I could also simply write EAB as in terms of mu's explicitly. That's not hard to do, but I thought this was more illuminating. So I can write the line element on the null hypersurfaces as follows. I write it as the area density rho of the determinant of H, right, which was the part I divided out to get E, times basically dz by dz bar. You all know that you can write the Euclidean metric on the plane as dz by dz bar. But yeah. But now if you want a curved metric, then you have to, or a general metric, then you have to put in more than just dz by dz bar. You have some dz by dz term and some dz bar by dz bar term. Okay. So you can parameterize it this way. With parameter mu here and mu bar, which is for a real metric, is the complex conjugate of mu. And then you have to put a little normalizing factor here so that what comes out here is actually the area. Okay. And so then you can see that since the line element divided by the area density is E, that E is entirely encoded in this mu. E had 2 degrees of freedom, was a real symmetric determinant 1 2-by-2 matrix, and now it has one complex degree.
So rho is not physical because it's just the around hypersymmetries or null symmetries.
No, rho is the area density in a space-like cup from the hypersurface.
Did you put it on your list of things that were in? Sorry, okay.
Yeah, well, actually, it's only rho at S0 is data, but it's...
Wait, is the way you say that the rho at outside S0 can be solved for the rho?
Yeah, in fact, it's very simple. It's rho 0 times v squared.
Okay.
Okay, and z here is theta 1 plus I theta. Okay, so then you can write down the bracket between mu 1 and mu bar, mu at the point 1 and mu bar at point 2. And it, well, it's not horribly complicated, it's not incredibly simple, somewhere in between, which is actually a nice sort of middle ground because you don't feel like you've done something totally trivial and yet it's not horrible. And the first line here, so let me explain a little bit. This is a delta function that says that only data on the same generator, actually here for the news, but this is quite generally true, only data on the same generator have non-zero possible. This is just a reflection of causality, because the only points that are causally related are points on the same generator. All points on distinct generators are space-like separated. So, okay, so that's what this is. This is something adjusting for the fact that the theta is representing more or less area as you go along. This factor here. H is a step function, which is it's 1 if 2 follows, if the point 2 follows the point 1, and 0 if it's the other way. And then there is some more mysterious stuff. The first line, certainly if you take this out, is recognizable as the, well, with some modification that I will mention, it's recognizable as just the Klein, the Poisson bracket for Klein-Gordon equation, for Klein-Gordon scalar on a null hypersurface. Okay? I think, when I was making this up, I sort of checked it in my mind, but checking more, perhaps we'll be certain, but I think, in fact, if you were to take the Poisson bracket of the Klein-Gordon equation on a null cone or in flat space, you would, space-time, you would also get this factor. Okay. I should also mention that this, although it's complicated, and mu depends in a slightly complicated way on changes of the coordinates theta, all of this is actually covariant under change of the theta term. Finally, I should mention a strange feature of this. This is not, in the Klein-Gordon equation, you would normally take not a step function that's 0 on one side and 1 on the other, but a step function that's minus a half on one side and plus a half on the other side. Okay. Somehow this would be more anti-symmetric. Well, the concrete problem taking this step function like this is that this doesn't, this actually does not preserve the reality of the metric. Okay. It doesn't preserve the complex conjugacy of mu and mu bar, which is a really bizarre thing.
You mean the transhuman?
Right, so in the phase space from the beginning, the phase space is the phase space of real data, so mu and mu bar are complex conjugates in the phase space. And you would expect that any Hamiltonian flow on this phase space would stay within the phase space, right? You would expect. So this was at first quite alarming, But it turns out you can live with it.
So you're saying if I take the complex conjugate of that guy, I don't get the same guy?
Yeah.
I don't get the same brackets.
Yeah.
So there's two brackets, the bracket and the complex conjugate.
Yeah.
Which is bizarre.
Which is bizarre. But, or you could say, well, you act with some suitably constructed, with a function that should be real on the phase space on some data, and you start with real data, and now you have complex data. So, but it turns out that this action, this complex, you don't produce any complex data. You excite a certain mode with a complex coefficient. And it turns out that this mode is actually, in a certain sense, unphysical. It doesn't affect any. It doesn't affect the metric on the interior of the domain of dependence. What it seems to correspond to this mode is gravitational shock waves skimming along here, exactly tangent to the surface, okay, changing the data, but not scattering into the interior of the domain of dependence. So it's a funny situation. I mean, we're used to thinking, to worrying, you know, does the data determine uniquely the solution and so on? But you always take for granted that the solution uniquely determines the data. But it doesn't in this case, because it's possible to have these shock waves that go along at the speed of light. And so you can have different data sets having the same solution.
And then it's not completely debunked. So it's not completely free.
It is free. You can take the
gauge symmetry, you're saying. No.
It's a sort of a gauge symmetry.
So
it's a gauge for the interior of the domain.
Is there a generator? What is the generator of symmetry of this gauge symmetry?
I don't know. There might be some way of looking at it so that there is a generator. I mean, I told you basically what I understand about. Well, no, I understand a fair bit more, but I can't answer the question. Okay. So let me finish now with. I started late, so I'm.
I need to get over kind of 15 minutes.
Okay, so I'll finish in a few minutes. Okay, so a nice thing about this data is that you can find a polarization. Okay, polarization is basically some maximal commuting set of data. I mean, you can give a more technical definition. These three data commute, and if you look at the surface in the phase space, where these are set constants, this is like the two form is degenerate, or this vanishes. So when pulled back to the surface, so in that sense they form a maximal. You can show that this means you can't put any more commuting any further functions of the phase space that commute for these guys that are not simply functions. So you could use these as configuration variables for a quantization. You could try to quantize with wave functions that depend on mu, rho, zero, and phi. Notice mu, not mu bar. Right? So it has to, they have to be holomorphic in mu. Okay, so that's nice. And I've been thinking, actually, during this day, I've been thinking a lot about this. But I won't tell you any more about it. I'll just tell you a nice little easy piece of the quantization of a very simple part of the algebra of Poisson, the Poisson algebra. Just as kind of a little toy thing. It also has a little to do with loops, and since this is a loopy place, it's good to mention. Okay, so let's define the area. Well, it's a reasonable definition, the area of S0 as the absolute value of rho 0 integrated over S0. I put the absolute value there. Normally, you don't worry about the possibility of being non-positive, but it turns out that this doesn't work if you don't put it. So I put it in explicitly. Now, our claim was that the hope, or what the thing we want to check, in a sense, is that the exponential of this area divided by 2 times the Planck area is equal to the dimensionality of some Hilbert space. Okay? So if you want to take that literally, then this ought to be an integer, right? It's going to be a dimensionality of Hilbert space, a finite dimension of Hilbert space. Of course, you could come and say, if it didn't turn out that way, say, wow, you know, we're just looking for an asymptote. But let's see if we can actually get an integer. Okay? So it turns out that rho has a non-zero bracket with only one thing, and that's this thing lambda. And it's a very simple bracket. It's just a non-equal type bracket. And so then we can...
lambda again?
Lambda was basically the inner product, or well, the logarithm of the inner product of the tangents to the generators going out on one side and the other side.
Infinity.
You can also
the reflection of having these guys being really affine.
Yeah, you can also see it that way. There are many ways of interpreting these data. But that's also true. Okay, so then it turns out, so let's take the loop quantization of scalars. If lambda is a scalar field, rho zero is its conjugate density, and then in this quantization, there exists a unitary operator. Where you can define a loop quantization in which there exists this unitary operator, which is e to the minus I lambda at some point p times some real constant k, which you can choose as constant as you like. Okay, but you have to choose it once and for all for the quantization. Okay, and what does this do? To the most, so if you just put an IH, multiply this by IH bar and say that this is a commutation relation, then according to that, what does this two operator do? Well, it adds H pi kappa Planck area, that comes from the H bar times T, times the delta function of P to rho zero. Okay, so you act once on a state with this. An eigenstate of rho zero, and then now you get a rho zero field, and now you get a little delta function peak added to this rho zero field. And so you plug this in and see what effect this has on A, and you find that what it does is add h pi k A Planck to the area. Okay, so this operator changes the area of A by this by integer steps or unit steps of A pi kappa A Planck. Okay. So the spectrum is just this A pi kappa A Planck times some positive integer, or not a zero or a positive but possibly zero integer. Okay. Positive because you have this absolute value. And then, well, so if you set your kappa equal to log natural logarithm of 2 over 4 pi, then this spectrum of the exponential of a over 2 a Planck has eigenvalues 2 to the n, okay, which is an integer. You're happy.
But here you don't have any Nielsen parameter dependence, so why would you expect the area to be quantized in the first place? Or another way to say that is that lambda is a hyperbolic angle. Therefore, it's a non-compact variable. And it's
Yeah, right. So and it's due.
Yeah, but there's no reason that you... Or whatever. Yeah, I mean,
but it's
no
immunity. You can quantize this way, if you like. And then it does give you an an integer spectrum. If you couldn't do that, then if you had a continuous spectrum, then it would be a little bit difficult to sustain this spectrum.
Well, I mean, this is a conjecture.
Yeah, I know, but it's interesting that you can, in fact.
Yeah, but it's kind of arbitrary. I mean, the usual discretization comes from the energy parameter. So there might be an argument that...
The discretization existed long before it was introduced.
No. The usual argument that there is discrete area spectrum. It's like it's not a...
This is not the spectrum. I think if you plug in for the spectrum of loop quantum gravity, you don't get...
This is a discretization, whereas in loop quantum gravity, at least the hope is that the discrete spectrum of area doesn't come from discretization. I can always discretize.
No, it's not discretization. It's how you quantize. It's not that I've chopped up something and made things into little.
Yeah.
I'm working on a lattice or something.
Of course, yeah.
Well, it's no lattice. This is just how I quantize.
Let's continue the discussion
again. Okay, so this is actually.
It's like a loop quantum cosmology. Okay, you can continue.
Yeah,
but it's a dynamic. But it's a dynamic time error in an action. So that is it's a, any coupling constant is put by hand, but it's a coupling constant. So it does.
Is this the end?
This is the end.
Okay.
Okay. Let me just answer one thing. I mean, I put this as a sort of a small entertainment and something quantical. I think there's a much more serious objection to this than what they're all saying. I mean, this is just one part of the algebra. You don't quantize by just taking a little piece of the algebra and quantize it back. You have to quantize the whole thing. That's the thing. And in fact, perhaps there's some reason that comes then that you have to put this. It's true. You gotta just put this cap.
But your view, the nodes that are free now, so they're not connecting to each other. Lambda, Rosen,
I don't think that doesn't mean that they're thinking in contact.
I mean, the mu thing is different, because mu depends on rho 0 and mu. The mu quantization is. This rho 0 lambda is completely independent on the mu.
No, because lambda has
rho
0 quantum.
So the mu is dependent.
What I mean is, if this were to commute also with. I mean, rho commutes with everything, so lambda. Lambda were to commute with everything as well, and you say, well, I take this sector, it's got nothing to do with anything else, I quantize it as I like, and I take the other sector, quantize that as I like, and paste it together to do what I want. But that's not the case. So, I mean, it could still be that I have a lot of freedom.
How do you actually tune into the more detailed about any calculus on brackets? Like, so you have a Hamiltonian somewhere?
No.
No?
Well, I mean, it could in principle.
But then where the reference calculus can be found? The expression that you found.
So the way I calculated them is by very roundabout procedure. I tried everything obvious and I failed. But then I found the following criterion. I can define a particularly nice set of diffeomorphism invariant functionals of the metric on the interior of the domain of dependence surface. And on these guys, which I call observables, but it's just a name because they're diffeomorphism. On these guys, I can define a Poisson bracket by Parle's prescription. Parle's, I don't know.
I think, maybe the question is before. You can describe phase space by just being the space of solution of the theory. There, you don't need these 2 plus 1 splitting, right? And this space of solution naturally comes with a symplectic form and with a bracket, with these pi-R's brackets. And that you don't have to refer to any time splitting.
Yeah.
That's the general thing with using.
Okay. But here is just kind of neat, although maybe there is a better way. But the pulse bracket is a beautiful thing. It's a formula for the Poisson bracket, which doesn't involve any of the usual canonical stuff. It's just, you just need the means functions for linear perturbation. You want to evaluate, if you have two phase space functions, right? And you evaluate the Poisson bracket, and you get another phase space function. So to get a number, you have to put some phase space point as a variable. The point in this case is a solution to Einstein's field equation. It's the space of solutions to Einstein's field equation. So now to evaluate this Poisson bracket between two Hermitian variables, you can write the Pauls bracket as simply in terms of the Green's function for linearized perturbations or linearized perturbations in the gravitational field about this solution where you're evaluating the Poisson bracket. So all you need to know is the Green's functions. You don't need to know anything about boundary terms and the action, about symplectic forms or anything. So that's a very clearly defined thing. And then I impose the requirement that my bracket on initial data should reproduce this Poisson bracket for observables when these observables are expressed in terms of the initial data. And from that I could get the Poisson bracket. So it's, on the one hand, it's appealingly physical, on the other hand, it's pretty random.
There's a paper out on this, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I showed it actually up there. Yeah, so there are several things on the web. Here in the lower margin, so there's a little PRL just came out. Well, it's a bit compressed, of course. And here's the 132-page version up here.
Okay, unless there are other questions, let's thank the speaker again.